Well, I have a wonderful electronic invention I want you to see. It looks something like this.
Hey, what's going on, Curiosity Builders? I'm Chris Martin, and you're listening to Getting Work to Work, a weekly podcast for creative entrepreneurs. Makers, artists, podcasters, writers, filmmakers, designers, and coders who are on a mission of bringing their ideas to life by creating new things and getting their work to work. Whether you're just starting out or have been at this creative life for some time, I hope you'll learn something new in this podcast, challenge your assumptions about what is possible, and chase big ideas so you can become who you were born to be. How would you describe your best work that you not only need to start, but also finish? What is the cost of not doing your best work? Who are the people in your success packs? These are three questions that author Charlie Gilkey addresses in his latest book, Start Finishing. And in this interview episode of Getting Work to Work, Charlie brings his background as a Joint Force Military Logistics Coordinator, PhD student, and entrepreneur to discuss what your best work is, the unified self, being creative giants, projects as mirrors and bridges, failure and success, and constructive creativity versus creative destruction. Show notes and links to resources mentioned in this episode can be found at gwtw.co/332. You'll also find links to stream the show on the major podcast platforms and an opportunity to sign up for my email newsletter, The Curiosity Lab. Each week, I send out some thoughts on curiosity along with books, videos, podcasts, and other resources is blowing my mind as well. Charlie, welcome to Getting Work to Work. Fun story, I've been told by many people that I need to have you on the show, so you've actually been on my list for a while now. So welcome, I'm glad that you're here.
I am glad to be here as well. And yeah, I'm just ready to rock this.
Awesome. So just to start out, what's one thing people should know about you?
Oh, this is always a hard one. So we might get into it a little bit later, but a lot of times people will see that I have a army background and I have a philosophy background and I'm in business and they're like, how does that work? How does that work on one person? For me, it's actually, it seems all really unified. Mm-hmm. One thing they should know about me is like those parts just sort of fit in that way. And also, and this is important when you write a productivity book, like the thing is, this is stuff that I have to work through and practice with and fall in a hole every day. So everything we're going to be talking about, it's not like I have it all figured out in right. The sense that, you know, it's one and done. I'm up on the hill. I've got this figured out. You know, the rest of you, you'll get here. It's more like, no, we're in the trenches every day, you know, trying to do our best work and learning as we go. And, you know, as soon as we make it through one level of the arena, you know, the door closes and then, you know, another one opens up and there's something bigger and different that comes through that one.
Yeah. It is such a fascinating origin story to go from pursuing a PhD in philosophy and being a Joint Force Military Logistics Coordinator to running Productive Flourishing. How do you do that?
How do you make that jump?
How do you go from one to the other?
Well, it was really, you know, the point was 2006, 2007, I was maintaining both of those careers in the Army and pursuing my PhD in philosophy. And, you know, like people do, I started a business, you know, as well on top of that, because I was having a really hard time getting it all done. And so I started doing a lot of the research, you know, a lot of the reading that you'll do in, you know, Getting Things Done and Seven Habits and just all the literature that's out there. And I kept finding myself having to translate and synthesize so much of it. And as an Army officer, one of the primary things are is you're a trainer, you're a teacher, right? And then I was a scholar, which meant I was also training. So it's super native for me to say, okay, I figured these things out. I'm already doing this, all this work. Might as well share it with other people so they don't have to learn the same things I just spent the last 10 hours learning. And that's mostly, to be honest, most of my business comes from falling in a hole, climbing back out of it and figuring out how to climb out of it, and then pointing to the hole and say, hey, by the way, there's a hole there. Don't fall in it. And also, if you've already fallen in it, here's how you get out of it. So I kept doing that. And along the way, what I realized is, with the work that I'm doing at Productive Flourishing, I got to be a unified self. I didn't have to show up in one uniform or one sort of way of presenting to the world and have to shut off a major component of myself.
Yeah.
And so it was the best of available options. And so I'm not one of those guys that started a business because I hated my careers or because I got fired or laid off or anything like that. I actually really did enjoy them, but I realized that for me, both of those careers were going to require me to limit how I could show up in the world and the work that I could do. And I found this venue through Productive Flourishing where I can pull in all the parts and be a full person.
I absolutely love this whole idea of the unified self, how you can bring all of the things together into one. Was that hard to do or did it just naturally fit together?
The easiest way to say it is that it was hard to let go of the governors that I had placed on myself.
Mm.
But I think for me and for a lot of us, we have to think about how much effort it takes to suppress who we are.
Yeah.
And what happens once we just say, you know what, screw it. Like, I've got this one life to live.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got this thing that I can provide for people that apparently is valuable. I'm going to do that and see what happens. Because I know what my current life is with these labels and blinders and, as an army officer, I was too philosophical. And as a philosopher, I was too much of an army officer. I'm like, I can't win. Right. But I'm one person. And so, it was hard to really shake the constraints, mm-hmm. Because it's one of those things, man, where a lot of times you end up carrying weight for so long, like you've got this huge backpack of burdens that you've placed on yourself for so long, and that becomes your normal. And for some weird reason, it feels like taking it off the backpack is going to be harder than just dropping it.
Mm.
But then once you drop, you realize, wait a second, I can do these things. But then you have to sort of rewrite all the stories about what you can and can't do.
Right.
And so there's that period of 3 or 4 years of just like, I don't have to do X because I don't have to show up in that way. Or, I don't have to hide this part of myself. And this comes up a lot in my writing. So there are at least 3, maybe 4 different voices of Charlie that will show up in my writing. And it was really hard. Because I'd be like, oh man, this post way too philosophical. What am I doing? I need this to be more practical, more actionable. And I'd be like, screw it. I'm just going to let it go. And then there'd be other ones where like, this is way too actionable. Like, maybe let's get some perspective. And all of those sort of fluid ways we show up, it can be quite challenging for some of us to be in a role that sort of makes you choose a lane and choose a way of being rather than being who you are and leveraging that.
Right. Oh, I really like that too. Just the whole idea of when you're writing is such a powerful revealer of the self that's coming out. And I just love that. Okay, if it's too philosophical, let's put some action. If it's too actionable, let's put perspective. I love that a lot.
Thanks. Yeah, it can make for some interesting moments as the inner muse and this and the editor fighting with each other about what needs to be happening. But usually, especially if I'm in a good writing groove, like it works out in the end.
Yeah, that's awesome. One of the things that really stood out when I was on your website, Productive Flourishing, was what you call the people that you help in your community, creative giants. As someone in the creative space, when I read that label, it makes me feel huge and powerful. Not necessarily like smelly and, kind of like the giants of things. But, I'd love to know the story behind creative giants.
Yeah, that's such an interesting one, at least to me, because part of the work that I've been doing over the last decade has been helping creative entrepreneurs and executives really with their strategy execution and really taking their ideas and getting them out there in the world and building teams. And I kept running into clients who were in this scenario where they were really talented, they were really compassionate, and they were really just driven, mm-hmm. but they kept having to like almost crouch. Like you'd see them like when you were talking to them, you seem sort of crouched. Like I went to this conference and like everybody was all like their minds were blown, and I was like, really? Really? Right? Or they may be talking about something, they just be blowing people's mind. I work with a lot of really smart folks. And so that's one of the issues, right? Mm-hmm. Is that they're unfortunately usually in the wrong room because they're one of the smartest people in the room. And so we have to get them in different rooms.
Mm-hmm.
So I just had this feeling, this image of like, there are these really powerful, huge and powerful beings, like what you talked about, feeling like they had to step over and around everybody or make themselves smaller to make other people feel more comfortable and to not hide who they actually were.
Yeah.
I was just like, you know what? Like, I'm no longer going to feed that story with them and just say, look, this is who you are, right? And being this smaller version of yourself is not helping you and it's not helping the world. So how about we actually lean into that? And how about we be honest about that? And, you know, I wrote a post that's been really popular about that on the website. And it turns out when you're creative giants, you end up with like 12 really distinct challenges. I'm not going to go through all of them, but part of it is because creative giants are so capable, they have the curse of too many talents or too much capabilities, and they can't decide what to do. And at the same time, because they are so talented, people give them all the work, give them all the responsibilities, because apparently that's what you do, right? You find the busy person and mm-hmm. you give them work to do. Like, you never find the slacker. And they're like, hey, you're not doing anything. I'm going to give you a bunch of work to do, because you know they're on the couch slacking, right? They're not going to do the work. So you find that person that's really achieving and really driven. You're like, oh, I'm going to ask them to do something because it's going to get done. And you just get piled up on and piled up on. And because creative giants are also super compassionate people and typically mm-hmm. really service-centered, they want to help folks. And so they end up taking on a lot of other people's projects and a lot of people's priorities, ending up being upside down when it comes to some of those commitments. Mm-hmm. And another one I'll put on, because this comes out a lot for creative giants, is like, there's a very deep part of them that knows that if they actually put up some boundaries, they actually use a little courage and actually like focused on a few things, that they would succeed and perform at a much higher level than they currently are. But because they're so talented and good and whatever that is, like, they're able to like not steady and still ace the test, mm-hmm. you know? And so they end up in a lot of like positions where they end up getting the second or third place trophy without it really trying. Mm-hmm. But a life of third place trophies is really frustrating.
Yeah.
You know, like, wow. At a certain point you have to say, like, I'm actually the best or one of the best. And that's a hard place for people to claim. And so creative giants, for some people like you, it makes them feel really strong and powerful. But if for other people, it makes them feel super cocky, right? Mm. Like, oh, like, who am I to say I'm a giant? And who is that person to call themselves a giant? And creative giants are people like Emily Dickinson and, you know, Leonardo da Vinci. And we're not any of those people. And I'm like, actually, we are, right? Mm. When you think about it, all those people were people who finished important work to them. Right. They're the ones that did the work that has introduced new themes and new ideas into our cultural lexicon. Mm-hmm. But the chief difference is not that they were brilliant. It's not mm-hmm. that they were better than any of us. It's that, one, they did the work. And granted, there are social constructs that made it different for them to do their work at the time. But we are creative giants in the same way. There's no difference between us and Oprah or us and whatever sort of person you want to look at that are saying, like, that icon of, you know, success and creativity or, you know, whatever that is, mm-hmm. that seed is within all of us.
Yeah. I like that you mentioned finishing, because it is the theme of your new book that comes out tomorrow, September 24th, which is called Start Finishing. So why write another book about productivity? Did David Allen get something wrong, or did he miss something?
I think so. I really respect David. I really respect his work. But we have to look at when the work was written and who it was for, mm-hmm. right? And so it was really, if you are a manager in a blue chip organization, David Allen's methodology is fantastic. It mm-hmm. really is. However, there are so many of us that are now off of that grid through different ways. We're remote workers. We work from home. We have our own mm-hmm. businesses. And some of the things that he would espouse as far as like the 2-minute rule and things like that are actually super counterproductive for those of us whose livelihood depends upon shipping creative ideas out to the marketplace, whether that marketplace is to your colleagues at work or whether it's to the broader marketplace through a business. Mm-hmm. And so it missed that for me, and it missed it for a lot of other folks who didn't resonate with the book. Again, I really appreciate the book and have incorporated as much of it as I can. The other thing is that, like, what I found when I was doing that research a decade ago is that particular book, for instance, was too granular for me. Yeah. And on the other hand, when you look into sort of the books that would be in the personal development side of things, they were way too removed from the actual work, right? So on the one hand, we had all the stuff about principles and values and things like that, but it's like, but how do I do the work, right? Yeah. And then the other side, we had the, you know, very good, like, you know, the next actions. And then we had the, you know, focusing on sort of those little tasks and things like that. But I was like, how does that translate into significant work? Which I found like so much of the tension was in the middle where projects live. Because I'm like a lot of people are, you give me a task list, I can work through it. I mean, I really can.
Yeah.
Just boom, 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 boom. But at the same time, at the end of the week, I can look back and say, what the hell have I done? Like, yeah. Have I actually pushed any of my significant projects forward? Like, it's not about getting done what's on your list. It's about what's on the list. And I know that sounds obvious, but when we look at how many people's lists don't include the things that matter most to them, and how frustrating it is to get to the end of a week or the end of a month and to see like, wow, I did 82 things this month, but these five things that really matter didn't do a damn thing.
Yeah.
That's really frustrating. And it ends up telling stories like that. So one reason I think this book is different is because it really does hone in on projects.
Yeah.
And how to do that, but not just projects, but a certain type of projects. Those types of projects that your soul yearns to do, those type of projects that I call your best work projects, that are those types of things where you would want to look back at the end of your life and say, you know what? Yes, I had to make some hard choices. Yes, there's way more that I wanted to do, but I'm so glad I got those things done. I'm so glad that I, for some people, it's writing a book, for some people, starting a business. And what I want to do is make our conversation about productivity and about work more inclusive, because for so long, this conversation about work and this conversation about productivity has been focused on economic work and economic productivity. And what that has done is left out many of us, but especially women, whose main axis of productivity is in relationships and people, cultivating people, growing people, birthing people, caretaking for people, and been left out of this conversation because it's been about, you know, the stuff they're making in the world, but not the people they're making in the world, not the communities they're making in the world. So ironically, we're talking about David Allen here. His third book I thought was his best, actually, which is Making It All Work. And it had a double entendre in it, which is he wanted to make everything work, and it didn't catch on in a way for people. But I'm sort of re-entering that conversation. It's like all of this work that we're doing needs to have equal par. And I want us to talk about the work of life as much as we talk about the life of work.
Yes. Well, I think that very much speaks to the unified self that you mentioned earlier. And as I hear you talking, and as I reflect on what you shared about the philosophical nature, the actionable nature, and all those different parts of yourself, when I think of what I've read in the book, it's very much all of those different areas. And I think that's awesome how that you were able to do that in one book.
Thank you. Thank you. It was challenging in many different ways because people still ask me, like, what's the book about? And again, the book comes out tomorrow, so I should know what the book is about. but I sort of, when there's like, well, it's a productivity book, I'm like, yeah, yes, and? Or like, so it's like a self-help book, and I'm like, yeah, yes, and? And so it's very much an and book. I'm very much an and person, but we're all and people. And I think when we divorce purpose, meaning, and, you know, greater contribution from the conversation of productivity, it's pretty hollow. Like, who needs to read another article about 17 ways to hack a shoebox? Right? Yes, we can do it, but really? That's where we want to spend our time.
Right.
And so, yeah, thanks for that feedback. It's been a challenge, and it's, I think, the challenge that I've carried with me for 12 years at Productive Flourishing, because they're like, oh, so the site's about productivity. I'm like, eh, yeah. and?
Yeah. Well, and I appreciate too, it's like whatever lens or frame of mind that you're having at the moment, you can almost read your book and get something with that frame of mind. So when I was originally reading it, I was very much in kind of a reflective philosophical state, so that when I got to the actionable part, I kind of tuned out a little bit. And it makes sense now, because if I went into it with, okay, I want some actionable stuff now, I'd probably skip over the beginning and jump into the actionable sections. And it's like, that to me is where, when you have a book that has multiple facets like that, it makes the book even more engaging and powerful, because you can read it again and again and again and get new things from it. That's awesome.
I love that. Thanks. You know, that's one of the best compliments I think I can receive as an author, because what I wanted to do was to write a book that sat on your shelf, not because mm-hmm. you didn't read it, but because you read it once and you knew mm-hmm. that there was a part of it that at a different point in time you would come back to.
Yeah.
Or because it's a reference. And so, to be honest, I just got the book yesterday when we're recording this. It's obviously not the day before launch, but I just got the book yesterday. And one of the things when we were sitting down with the production team is like, what do we want this book to be? And I was like, one, I don't want it to be a big blocky, like, mm-hmm. I don't want it to be just a wall of words. That's not going to be helpful. And so I was like, it's more like a cookbook or a menu book, in that like there are these different parts we're going to talk about, but then we're going to have these sections mm-hmm. where you can just dive right in and get what you need there. And then you can read around it. And so they took it and run with it and made this really great book. And I've seen it in the full color formats. Yeah. Oh, I mean, cool. Just yesterday. And it's wonderful. And I was like, yeah, that's it. That's what I wanted it to be. Because sometimes you want to sit down and you want to have that mindgasm, right? And just be like, whoa, yes. I really need it today. And other times you ain't got time for that, right? Other times it's like, I'm stuck in a project. How do I mm-hmm. get out of it? And so the book, you know, it has three parts. That, and I say it in the beginning, but like, if you're definitely showing up and you're like, I'm stuck, the days to day, my days are not adding up for me, what's going on? Read part three. I got you. Right. But if it's like, actually, I'm in a good place, I'm in the summer and I'm maybe reflecting my life, like read part one. Right. Yeah. And then there's the one that's in the middle, where it's like, I've got these ideas and I don't know how to convert them into projects. And that's part mm-hmm. two.
Yeah. One of the things that really blew my mind was the section where you're talking about projects as being mirrors mm-hmm. and reflecting what's going on inside and outside. I mean, I had to read that a couple of times, not because I was missing something, but because it was ringing true for me. I mean, could you go a little deeper into this idea of projects as mirrors?
Yeah, and thanks so much for that. So, when, especially for best work projects, especially for work, for projects that are really calling out the deepest parts of you. Mm-hmm. And it's that really human letting the inside part of you out part of things. Mm-hmm. Those are going to really show you what's going on in your world, in the sense of, you know, one of the first things that will come up for people when we start talking about those types of projects is they see all of the constraints in their life, and they see mm-hmm. all of the different things keeping them from doing this thing. And I think that's a wonderful mirror, right? In a mm-hmm. way, because it's like, oh, it's not that this person is somehow uniquely defective. It's not that they, you know, can't ever get their shit together. It's that the structures around them yeah. are impeding them in different ways. Okay, so what are you going to do about that? And then what a project like this will do is reflect your inner head trash about your capabilities, and are you the right person to do this? And what about that one time you tried that thing and it failed? And, mm-hmm. you know, ever since then, you carried that sort of baggage of failure with you. Like, it reflects all of that stuff will come up for you when you choose these types of projects. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I really want people to take an idea and work through it in the book. And I'm completely comfortable with the fact that they see that and are like, wait a second. So what's going on? Right. And the book sort of goes through, you know, what are some different factors that are keeping them from doing that? But even that's super powerful. So anyone to have the project show them that mm-hmm. is fantastic. But I didn't nail this as much as I would have liked to at the end of the book. The other way that projects are mirrors is that when you stand tall, when you work through it and you ship your project, it reflects back to you who you are. So all of the stories, especially the self-defeating ones, so all the head trash, all of the limiting beliefs, when you complete that project, it's sitting there looking at you like, what are you doing about it? Right? Because that's no longer true. If you've told yourself in some way that you maybe you're not an author and you write a book, well, guess what? you're an author.
Yeah.
Right. Or I can't do something. And then you do it. That project is sitting there looking at you and reflecting back who you actually are in the most positive of ways. And even though we have a negativity bias, I think a lot of times where we'll carry the weight of our failures more than we'll carry the weight of our successes. You rack up enough successes and get clear about that, and it becomes ever more absurd for you to continue to hold on to this belief that you're not X when you're doing all the things that would make you X.
Right.
Right. You've done that. So why hang on to that thought? Like, where is that coming from? And so they're mirrors because they can reflect who you are in the world. They're mirrors because they can reflect who you are to yourself. And they're mirrors because they can reflect what's going on in the world around you. So it's super powerful when you think about that. And I think all too often we shy away from the work that matters most because we don't like what we at first see. But the gift of seeing it is that you can overcome it.
Yeah. Well, and the fact that you can, not to be cliche about it, but you can rewrite your story. You have to rewrite your story in order to not keep building upon the foundation of a lie.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the thing about it is like, failure is not an indication of anyone's character. It's an indication of a moment in time. But when we make our failures represent our characters, or we make it say something about who we are as people, then it's very hard to rewrite those stories because the writer views his or herself as flawed. Right. But when it's just a moment in time, there's just a lack of alignment. It's just at that given point in time, you weren't where you needed to be, either priorities wise or resources wise or investment wise, whatever it might be. It's not about you and it's not about who you are as a person. It's about that particular time. This time is different. You are a different person because you've lived. Right. And so, yeah. And I think that's the grace of it, in that, you know, we get to write our stories. And since we get to write our stories, we might as well write a good one.
I'm laughing because it's reminding me of something that I read this morning with Robert McKee in his book Story, where he's talking about the different genres and subgenres of writing and storytelling. And he's like, the first thing that you have to do is pick a genre, and then you have to research it so that you can understand the rules in which the genre works. And I think that's a lot like our life. We have to understand the life that we're living so that we can thereby understand the rules in which we need to live our life.
And absolutely. I'm going to riff on that just a little bit more, right?
Please do.
Maybe instead of the fact that we're living a tragedy, maybe we're living an epic.
Yeah.
Right? Or maybe, comedy. Or comedy, right? or drama or whatever. Like, you can pick which of those it is. But like, and I know that I've stressed so much of the negative stories that we have. It's because I've seen so many creative giants. I've seen so many creative people who have given up on themselves. And in a weird way, they've given up on their ability to do, but they still hold on to their ability to dream. And that is can be a very frustrating place to be, because you're forever going to be in tension. You're forever going to be frustrated because the dream that you have, you don't see yourself as the person that can be in that dream. You know, to your point, we can write a different story. We can pick a different genre.
Yeah.
And I think we are not responsible in so many ways of what happens to us, but we can be responsible for the way we react to what happens to us. Yes. And that moment of choice, that is, I think, one of the quintessential human responses, right? It's why we're here, and it's why we're able to talk, you know, in this wonderful technology. We've mastered the very energy of the universe because there have been enough people that have been in a situation, enough humans, proto-humans even, that have been in situations and had a different response. And that is the seed we all carry within us.
Yeah. So how do we take all this wonderful stuff and write a more positive story, overcome the head trash, overcome the negative stories, and have a more positive either outlook or reflection or story?
Well, there's about six books there. But I think, you know, I've talked so much about mindset because so much of what we try to do is we try to work on the external stuff and try to fix what's going on outside, but we're not able to do any better. And I think about it like this, like we're so busy trying to make a better car, but the driver is going to drive that car like a golf cart. It doesn't matter how we soup it up. It doesn't matter. They're going to drive it like a golf cart. And we may find that, you know, that Ford Focus or Honda Accord can do a lot more than we think it could do. We don't need so much of the focus on the car. We need it on the driver. And that's where we start talking about some of these questions of like how confident, courageous, disciplined, aware, and boundaried we are in our life will often determine how many of the projects we can do in our life. There's a very big link between that. The better the driver, the better they're able to use whatever car they have. One place I'm going to focus on this, though, to answer the how do we do that, is build a supportive group of people around you.
Yes.
And so I call them success packs.
And yes, and I loved it. I loved the success pack so much.
Thanks. And your success pack is the group of yay-sayers that you intentionally put as part of your team. Now, what I want to say is we spend an inordinate amount of time trying to make the naysayers in our life happy and are trying to accommodate them. But as the philosopher, poet, and musician Taylor Swift has said, haters are going to hate, right? They just are. And the odds of us winning over a naysayer are not good. And even if we do it, it comes at the cost of neglecting our yay-sayers, who are those people who already believe in you. Who already see you for who you are. They're the type of people that when you say you've done something that would be braggarty for other people, they'd be like, of course you did that. We've all known that you can do that. Thanks for joining the party, right? Or they're the people when you talk to them about what you're going to do, they ask you how you're going to be successful. They don't question whether you're going to be successful.
Yes.
And that's a big difference. How are we going to get there versus you can't get there, right? Is a big difference. So you stack the deck with your success pack with yay-sayers, but there are four different types of yay-sayers you would want to put. First is your guides. Your guides are like your Yodas or your Gandalfs, your Dumbledores, whatever sort of wise sage that you would want to put up there. Their main job is to shift your worldview, shift your paradigms, shift your perspective with whatever problem that you have. So they can be religious figures, they can be high achieving professionals, you know, in different ones. But what's super important is that their character resonates with you. There are all sorts of ways to win and do things in this world, some of which are not going to resonate with your values and your priorities.
Right.
So don't put someone on your success pack whose character you disagree with, because when they tell you something, it's always going to be like, yeah, that's not the way I would do it because I'm not going to do it, you know, in that, you know, parentheses, morally bad way that you would do it. Right. So,
right.
And the other thing about your guides is that they tend, because they are paradigm shifters and worldview shifters, right? They tend to say things like use the force or remember who you are, or, you know, things like it never makes sense in the moment.
Right.
You're always, what the hell does that mean? And then 6 months, a year, 2 years later, it's like, oh, right. Then it hits you, but you couldn't see it at the time. Right. And you're like, oh, that's what I mean. Now is the moment that it makes sense. And so they can be incredibly frustrating, but they have a role. I just want people to remember that unless you're choosing a religious guide, remember that they're just people like you, right? Just people like you that have been walking the road a little bit longer. They are human. So humanize your guides and they actually become more powerful. Because you recognize that that guide is just some future time slice of yourself, right? So that's the first one, guides.
Do you have an example of your one that you would put in that category for yourself?
Yeah, so I have quite a few. Lao Tzu, Aristotle, Maya Angelou, Oprah in some ways, Peter Drucker, Seth Godin is actually one of my guides as well. So I'm fortunate in that there are actual conversations I can have with that human. He's an amazing human too. Right. And so those are the folks that, you know, when I'm like, what would Seth do or what would Maya do or what would, you know, what would Peter say about this one? Right. That's really, really helpful for me. A second kind of person is your peer. And your peers are the people that are kind of walking shoulder to shoulder with you. They're the ones that you can actually probably ring up or call or text and they can, they'll actually weigh in on you. Your guides are much further removed from that. right? Yeah. They may not be working in the project with you, but they're kind of around your project. So you can, you know, mastermind with them. You can do some co-coaching. It could be a friend that you meet once a month and you actually talk about what's going on in life as opposed to just talking about the weather and what's going on with the kids, right? Not that those are wrong. Not that there's anything wrong with weather and kids, but at a certain point, there's a level of conversation under that that really strikes who you are and where you're trying to go. Mm-hmm. And so you put some peers on your team and you're really looking for a diverse group of peers. And one of the things I'm going to pause here for is we all need, for lack of better words, that drill sergeant peer, or we need that tough teacher peer.
Yes.
Right. That, like, you know, if they say it's good, that it's good. And also if, like, you get feedback from them, you know, it's not personal, but, like, they are legitimately trying to get better. And the reason I say that is because I think we've gotten too Pollyanna about things. And, like, if someone's like, oh, that's great, and maybe try X, Y, and Z, too many people are like, but I just wanted you to see me and feel me, which is great. Except for we need those people in our lives because they make us better, right? Yes. And I think as a challenge for listeners, if you can find ways to supportively be that for your friends and the people in your packs, it can be incredibly valuable. At the same time, it's incredibly awkward to be that person, you know? yeah, when everyone's like, yeah, this is awesome. And this one's like, it's great. And, you know, you get like 17 different things that you can change and do better about it. Or that friend that will straight up tell you, like, this ain't your best work, right? You phone this one in. That's super hard to hear in the moment, but would you rather not hear that?
Oh, you definitely want to hear that.
Yeah. So stings, those are your peers. Though. Yeah, it stings. It stings. You'd be mad for a week, but
yeah.
Better to be mad for a week than frustrated for a decade.
Oof, you know? So true.
So the third group of people are your supporters. And these are the people that are in the project with you. Mm-hmm. They have a hands on deck, as it were. And I really want people to include people from their personal life, just as much as their coworkers and teammates and, you know, all the people they pay or are paid by. Because this could be the neighbor kids that watch your pet's kids or parents when you're working on your project. They could be people who are cutting your grass so that you're not out there on a Saturday and instead you're doing whatever your best work is. They could be all sorts of different people. And you got to think, who can support me with getting this project done? And then lastly, are you beneficiaries? And these are the people other than you who benefit from you completing your project. These are real people that you can reach out to. Now, when I talk about this, I've been talking about this stuff for years, I can always see the hand in the back and it goes up. And here's, Chris, the hand goes, how do I get more guides? How do I enroll my guides? And I understand where that's coming from. And what I want to encourage people to think is, how do you get in more touch with your beneficiaries?
Yes.
How do you get closer to them and really understand that? And I say that for two reasons. One, when you get stuck with your project and you don't know which way to go, and you're sort of that cerebrally stuck, like, I don't know if this is working. It could be X, it could be Y. Your beneficiaries are the people to ask, not your guides, not your peers, not your supporters, because you're not making it for them.
Right.
They might benefit in different ways, and you can be in multiple groups. But if someone is not a true beneficiary of your thing, you can't take anything that anyone else says really that seriously. You need to know who you're serving and what they need and what their preferences are. So that's one. The second one is, when you get emotionally stuck, it's easy to remember that it's not just about you. It's about those other people. Maybe they're 5 people. Maybe they're 10 people. Maybe they're thousands of people. I don't know. Right? I don't know what your project is. We all too often will give up on ourselves where we wouldn't give up on other people. We would check out on ourselves, but we won't check out on other people's. And sometimes, a lot of times with your best work project, you need to tap into that little left in the tank that is really centered on other people. And so being super in touch with your guides and hearing their feedback. And I could tell you, I'm fortunate. I've been really humbled and blessed with this book. And we started getting early readers, like really early, like 6 months early.
Wow.
And there's not a day that I don't get an email or a text or see some of our street team that are sharing what's going on for them. And it's really provided so much fuel for me because, you know, this stuff is the back of my head. I've been talking about it and thinking about it for 15 years. It's old hat. No one cares. Just another productivity book, right? All that head trash that comes right. up until someone leaves you a text and it's like, this blew me away. I've been reeling over this for 3 days. Or because of that, I did this thing that I haven't been done for 2 years because I've been putting it off.
Mm, that's awesome.
It's so awesome. And it's like, that's why I'm doing this, right? That's mm-hmm. that's why in the end of the day, because though I have to practice what's in the book every day, like I didn't need the book to do that, right? I could just do the work mm-hmm. on my own. Yeah. But just to really see that impact's made such a difference. And so it translates to things like being on this interview with you, because like I know that it's not just about me. It's about someone else that hasn't gotten a book yet mm-hmm. that may be able to do that thing that they've been longing to do because of something that's in the book or that it moves them one step closer to whatever their best life looks like.
Yeah. One thing I want to ask real quick is, why do you think people confuse the guides and the beneficiaries?
They think the guides have the answer or the resources, or they got that thing, that magical thing that the person seeking the guide doesn't have. Mm-hmm. Even though your guides will normally remind you that you've already got what you need. Mm. Right? That's the funny thing about it. It oftentimes will come down to you have what it takes, just be you and some version of that. And so if we look to the guides for that affirmation. Mm-hmm. And we look to that in that sense of like needing that buoy to hang on to in the ocean of overwhelm that can sometimes come up with projects. And so they're that sort of thing like that. But really, it's the beneficiaries that are the ones that can get you there.
Yeah,
I think that's part of it. And I think many people have just that belief that there's that one thing missing. And if they just had that one thing, then X would happen, whatever X is great for them, right? And so when we look at guides and things like that, it's like, oh, maybe they can help me either give me that X or show me how to find the X. Mm. And that's not what your guides are going to do, really.
Yeah.
Your peers might, but your guides are going to be different. So I think that's like, we being humans are very weird creatures, right? Because we have to live in these tensions. Right. On the one hand, there are times where we just really want someone who knows what's going on to tell us what to do. It's like, will someone please be the adult in the room and then just tell me what to do, please. Right.
Yes.
And then the very same person will reject authorities, reject someone telling them what to do. Mm-hmm. So we're stuck in this weird position where we want to be told what to do, but we don't want to be told what to do.
Yes.
Or maybe we want to be told what to do by people we want to tell us what to do, as long as they tell us what to do in a way, and what they tell us to do is actually something we want to do. Mm. Right. So we're very weird about these types of things. And so that's where I think chasing guides can be really unhelpful. Mm-hmm. Because when you really stay on mission and you stay on purpose, your beneficiaries can actually tell you specifically what to do, right? I need this thing, mm-hmm. right? This is a very clear thing. And what you made either does that or doesn't do it. And if your beneficiaries say, yes, this works, this was exactly what I need, like, they're right, right? Don't argue with them. Another thing that I'll say here. No, I'm serious here, because people will be like, well, this was great, exactly what I need. And it's like, well, but yeah, I could have done X, Y. Are you sure you don't need this? Like, no, they are right. Let it go. Move to the next thing.
That's so true. So when people have start finishing in their hand, they finish the last page and they close the book and put it down, what do you hope the book inspires them to do?
I hope it inspires them to blow the dust off of whatever project they have in some literal or metaphorical drawer somewhere mm-hmm. where they've been waiting on the someday, where the time is right, or when they had what they needed, or when the stars aligned to work on that thing. I hope, I really, really hope that it encourages them to say, you know what? Today is that day. Mm. Today is that day where I'm actually going to get into this project. I'm going to do the thrashing. I'm going to build the team around me. And I'm going to do the work, because I want people to see the cost of not doing the work. Right. And yeah. You know, I call it the creative constipation that we have when we take on too many ideas, we take on too much inspiration, and we take on, you know, we commit to too much, but we're not, you know, pushing it out in the world, as it were.
Right.
And we get toxic, just like, you know, physical constipation.
Yes. We need to creatively shit on people.
We do. And you're not lying in the sense of, like, as creative beings, we are either creating or we're destroying something.
Mm-hmm.
And what, so we destroy by destroying relationships because we're resentful or we're envious or we're frustrated that, you know, people aren't letting us do what we want to do. We can destroy our resources and our time and our mindless grazing on social media or Netflix or our resources when we're going through retail therapy. Right.
Yeah.
But what we usually destroy is ourselves.
Yeah.
And start telling different stories about ourselves and the type of people we aren't versus the type of people we can be. And so I really hope people get to the end of the book and see that the gap between who they are and the person they want to be is not something about character. It's not something about competency. It's about the projects and the work that's between where they are now and between where they want to be. And I hope they grab one of those projects and start becoming.
Nice. Do you have a project that's gathering dust that you're going to work on next?
I don't know. And I say I don't know because this book launch, this whole book project has opened up so many different doors that I'm not in a point where I'm assessing which one to go through because I'm still firmly in the center of this room. And so once this project is done and I do much of the work that's in the book itself, that's where I'll look and say, okay, now is the time. And the one that jumps up for me and has been sort of the one that's been hanging out there for the longest time is whether I'm going to complete my PhD in philosophy. I legit don't know. I don't know if I'm going to be like, nah, I think that was for a season of my life and I'm in a new season of my life and it's not a bridge for me, right? Projects are mirrors, but they're also bridges. And so what would that particular project bridge for me at this point? Where would it get me that I'm not already going to be able to get to? Or maybe it's like, you know, I've completed something. So I'm just open to a lot of things, but I don't have that burning, yearning feeling that there's something that I'm not getting to right in this moment because I'm just happen to be where I need to be.
Yeah. It sounds like too, that you've found the freedom to finish what needs to be finished, start what needs to get started, and quit what needs to be quit.
Yeah. Yeah. I have joked that my next book may be on quitting. Seriously.
I'd read it.
Yeah. Except for I'd have to think, how is this different than Seth Godin's The Dip, which is where I tell most people to go when they need to quit something. But I think is the art. Like, we focus too much on starting, not nearly enough on finishing, right? Which is what this book is about. But I think there's a gift and a grace and peace that comes from being able to see that things that we are carrying no longer serve us and we need to quit them. And again, quitting is also not a character flaw. It's just recognizing that, again, the project is not a bridge to where you're trying to go anymore.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, Charlie, this has been a fantastic conversation. Even though you've mentioned several resources and books throughout this episode, I just have to ask, what was the last book or podcast that blew your mind?
The one that I've gotten the most mileage out of recently is Marshall Goldsmith's Triggers. I think along with like his and James Clear's Atomic Habits are like a 1-2 punch for life change.
Nice.
They are really great when read together. And so I read it 2 years ago. I read it about 4 months ago, and I just continue to go back to it. So kudos to Marshall. It's just a fantastic book.
Awesome. Well, Charlie, thank you so much for being a guest on Getting Work to Work. I wish you all the success in the book launch tomorrow. And thank you just for writing a book that I think will help a lot of people.
Thanks so much for having me, Chris. It's been a blast.
I really hope you enjoyed this interview with Charlie. I really had a great time talking with him about his new book and really getting into the philosophy and action of being an entrepreneur. Be sure to head to startfinishingbook.com to learn more about Start Finishing and learn more about Charlie. There you can read a sample chapter and pick up your copy when it hits the shelves tomorrow. I really do hope you get a lot from the book and you can start bringing your best work to life. Until next time, may creativity and curiosity fuel your life.